In 1546, the 79-year-old Pope Paul III confidently called on the 71-year-old Michelangelo to be chief architect and superintendent of the rebuilding of St. Peter's. Michelangelo objected that architecture was not his vocation, but against his will, he took on the job at the Pope's command. The rebuilding of the Basilica had been going on for 41 years, plagued by vacillating plans from Bramante's simple Greek cross to San Gallo's complex Latin cross. This was to be the grand project of his next 17 years. He resisted all efforts to distract or seduce him from the job or remove him from it. He stayed on, but the work was not completed in his lifetime. The project was so vast, and so many architects had a hand, that it is not easy to separate the parts for which Michelangelo should be credited. There remained, however, Michelangelo's grand and simple concept for the building, a dome of the heavens over the four cardinal points of the earth. A cult of Michelangelo began to appear about 1540, when the vigorous creator was only 65. The popes sanctified his plans for St. Peter's and took measures to prevent the slightest change. No longer painting to order by the hour as a minion of court or cathedral, the creator, the genius artist, had become an inspired source sought after by Pope and Prince. The Sistine ceiling, the Last Judgment, displayed the new independence of the artist. The terrifying power of the inspired artist would leave its mark on the future of the arts. The genius of Michelangelo inspired others to make a fetish of genius. Part 9, Composing for the Community, a Protestant Music. It is not surprising that Johann Sebastian Bach, the first colossus of music in an age that idealized the artist genius, insisted that the composer was essentially a craftsman. For centuries in Europe, other crafts had been handed down in families, and often they took their family name from their craft. Vividly aware that he descended from seven generations of musicians, he composed his own Genealogy of the Musical Bachs and saw himself as heir of a craft tradition. There was, he believed, a right way for composing any piece of music, even for what was called a free fantasy. The composer's satisfaction came not from bold original plunges, but from producing what was properly expected. By his own teaching, Bach demonstrated his belief that composing could be taught. He was instructing his pupils in a spiritual craft, not just an instrumental technique. He himself had the rules so clearly in mind that the manuscripts of his works were remarkably clean and uncorrected, and he offered guidance to his sons and other novice composers with his little organ book, his well-tempered clavier, and his Art of the Fugue. Bach's elaborations of contrapuntal technique seemed to justify the fears of wordless music expressed by St. Augustine, Pope Gregory the Great, and others. They had rightly suspected that when music became wordless, it could easily become an icon, a form of creation all its own. Music would be the messenger of musical charms in place of heavenly truths. The rise of the arts of music in the West would be a dual story, of the liberation from fear of instruments and also of the elaboration of vocal music. From antiquity to the Middle Ages, music had a career of narrowing meaning, from the Pythagorean music of the spheres to the Gregorian music of the word. But pious efforts to keep the creators of music on this straight track inevitably failed. In modern times, as music became an expanding realm of creation, it became more and more secularized. While Bach was the last great composer to create mostly church music, he has also been acclaimed as the first great figure of modern music, a living bridge between the music of the word and the music of instruments. In his time, Bach was admired more as an organist and expert on organs than as a composer. The organ was an ancient instrument known in Hellenistic Alexandria, 3rd century BC, and across the Roman Empire. The 17th and early 18th centuries, the age of Bach, was the golden age of the organ, and some of the best organs were being built in northern and central Germany. Reputedly, the greatest organ builder of all time, Gottfried Silbermann, did his work in Dresden, a city Bach repeatedly visited, and on whose organs he played. Born in 1685 into a musical family in Eisenach in Thuringia, next door to Silbermann's Saxony, Johann Sebastian Bach naturally made his debut with the organ. Even before he was 23, he created his Toccata and Fugue in D minor, his Prelude and Fugue in D major, and his Passacaglia in C minor, some of his most famous organ works. And he composed a cantata called Gott ist mein König, meaning God is my king, his first work to be published. In 1708, as organist and court musician to the imperious Duke Wilhelm Ernst, he continued to compose toccatas, fugues, and fantasias for the organ, and he was finally promoted to concertmaster in 1714. Now it was his duty to compose a new cantata each month, for in those days the church musician, like the court musician, was expected not merely to perform the music of others, but to present music of his own. And Bach began composing some of his most brilliant vocal music, a vast body of Lutheran cantatas, of which some 200 survive. Into his sacred vocal music, he incorporated recitatives and arias in a quasi-operatic style, things he had heard in the works of Vivaldi and others, and gave a lesser role to the chorus. When he received an invitation to be director of music to Prince Leopold of Cothen, the Duke of Weimar's brother-in-law, the outraged Duke jailed him for a month, then ordered his dismissal in disgrace. At Weimar, before the age of 32, he had already created a body of music that would have brought immortality to a lesser composer. These included his Little Organ Book, 17 of his 18 Great Chorale Preludes, and most of his Organ Preludes and Fugues. Cothen, where he was not required to compose church music, but where his responsibilities were mainly for chamber and orchestral performances, provided Bach the incentive to compose more secular music, including sonatas for violin and clavier, the Brandenburg concertos, completed at Cothen but dedicated to the Margrave of Brandenburg, his little clavier book, his well-tempered clavier, two books, each of 24 preludes and fugues, cantatas for festive occasions, and various dance suites and concertos. In 1723, having passed a test of his Lutheran orthodoxy, he became cantor and musical director of St. Thomas's Church in Leipzig, a cosmopolitan cultural center, where he would remain until his death in 1750. Besides running a choir school for boys, he had heavy obligations as composer, director, and performer. In the first 4 years, he composed some 150 cantatas for Sundays and the major festivals. His offerings at Leipzig included some of his masterpieces, The Passion According to St. John and The Passion According to St. Matthew, which startled the congregation by its elaborate operatic character. Unhappy with his working conditions and the incompetent choir at his disposal, in 1730 he again began looking for a post elsewhere. He gave less attention to his cantatas and devoted himself to the keyboard pieces for his clavier Ubang, which included the Italian concerto, organ pieces, and the Goldberg variations. In the hope that he would be named court composer, Bach put theological scruples aside and created his most famous work, the Mass in B minor, sometimes called the greatest piece of Western music ever composed. He made in the first instance for Augustus III, Elector of Saxony, who was a Catholic. It remained a pinnacle of modern religious music. While Bach reached out to secular forms, his remarkable work was both a fulfillment and a byproduct of the limitations of churchly music. His inability to settle into a comfortable routine prevented his having a single conventional career for town or court or church. In variety, Bach's brilliant music is unexcelled among modern composers. His famous well-tempered clavier consisted of two installments of 24 each, in each of the 12 major and minor keys. His numerous clavier suites adapted the French and Italian styles. His six delightful Brandenburg concertos and Goldberg variations still charm audiences who do not attend the church. All these were noted for their intricate contrapuntal technique in the styles of his time. Bach's vocal music, music of the word, attained a grandeur that might have worried Luther and has never been excelled in music for the church. His secular cantatas, which he called Drama per Musica, he sometimes adapted to sacred texts. His Passions, settings of the gospel story in oratorio form for Easter services, were dramatic triumphs. Although Bach never wrote an opera, there are few operatic feats not found in his Passions, and with a dramatic coherence seldom found in opera. Bach, the craftsman, also did more than his bit to perpetuate his craft by didactic works. While his well-tempered clavier exemplified the range of Baroque keyboard compositions, it was intended to be an argument for the tempered scale of equal semitones as against the old natural scale. The music of instruments, from court to concert. The arts of instrument creative music changed the relation of performer to audience. The elaboration of musical instruments, increasingly specialized and requiring increasing skill, opened a widening gulf between performer and listener. A product of this rise of instrumental music, a grand creation of Western music, was the symphony. The great creators of symphony had at hand a new musical form, along with a newly elaborated array of instruments in an orchestra, in communities eager to support their work. All these elements came into being slowly after the Renaissance, the product of some people we know and of more who remain anonymous. Just as the Gregorian chant enlisted music for the church, the symphony and its orchestra signaled the emergence of instrumental music as an art in its own right, becoming dependent not on prince or church, but on a public of music lovers. In this story, Haydn, Mozart, and Beethoven played crucial roles in their creation of the modern symphony. Their lives overlapped. They knew and influenced each other, but their careers and their products were spectacularly distinctive. Joseph Haydn, often called the father of the symphony, found his opportunity and his challenge in a small but rich principality in Western Hungary. Born in 1732 into the family of a wheelwright in an eastern Austrian village near the Hungarian border, he fortunately impressed the choir master of the Cathedral of St. Stephen in Vienna, who toured the countryside to find choristers. The beauty of the 8-year-old Haydn's voice and his remarkable ability to trill his notes brought him the reward of a pocketful of cherries, which he never forgot, and an invitation to the choir school of St. Stephen. When his voice changed, he was dropped from the school and at 17 had to shift for himself in the big city. He took young pupils and made music for dances and serenades while he taught himself musical theory in the works of C.P.E. Bach and others. Recommended by his aristocratic pupils in 1758, he became music director in the chapel of a minor Bohemian nobleman, Count Morzin. When Morzin found he could not afford a 16-piece orchestra, it was lucky for young Haydn. His first symphony, composed for Count Morzin, had already charmed a grander patron, Prince Paul Anton Esterházy. The prince himself played the violin and cello and admired the young Haydn, whom he'd engaged as assistant conductor of his large and active orchestra. Haydn helped make the prince's castle, named Esterháza, famous by attracting the best singers from Italy and musicians from all over for his celebrated orchestra, from 16 to 22 players. Haydn's musicians, engaged for the season without their families, were exhausted by the frequent performances and endless rehearsals that stretched their stay deep into the autumn. Papa Haydn looked after them and tried to persuade the prince to send musicians on furlough back to their families. Hoping the prince would get the message, he even wrote a farewell symphony in which the sounds of one instrument after another ceased as each player put out his candle. Haydn spent some 30 years, most of his adult life, in this gilded prison, not lacking performers or appreciative audiences for his compositions. As his fame grew, calls for new compositions multiplied, even exceeding his fantastic powers of creation. In September 1790, Haydn's patron of 28 years died, succeeded by his son Prince Anton, who had no interest in music and dismissed all the musicians except Haydn himself and a few others to carry on the chapel services. With the pension, now feeling free to leave Esterháza, Haydn moved so hastily to Vienna that he left many of his belongings behind. At last, Haydn, nearly 60, was being tempted out into the world. Luckily, the winning invitation was from John Peter Salomon, a German-born violinist and concert organizer who'd settled in London. Haydn's reach to the world would enlarge his music, for his London symphonies showed a mastery of instruments, a melody and wit that excelled his earlier output. English audiences responded with frenzied enthusiasm. The English experience had stimulated him to compose some 800 pages of music and widened his hopes for himself. He'd been moved by the oratorios at the Handel commemoration in Westminster Abbey in 1791, and back in Vienna tried his hand again at that form. The product was two oratorios, both derived from English text. Composing The Creation, with a libretto based on Milton's Paradise Lost, and the book of Genesis, he said, put him in closer touch than ever with his Creator, and it was a public success when performed in 1798.